Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is so delicious, so unbelievable, no word exists to describe it. It's better than mind-blowing, it's mouth-blowing. Bright, citrusy, and spicy, this newest flavor from Captain Morgan is a balanced blend of sweetness with delicious notes of lime and slightly spicy chili flavor that is great for an escape outdoors with your crew or your next hangout. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is best enjoyed as an ice-cold shot or as a chili lime twist on a classic as a spicy daiquiri. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, a touch of sweet, a kick of heat. Please drink responsibly. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, premium Caribbean rum with natural flavors, 35% alcohol by volume, Captain Morgan Rum Co., New York, New York.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
I am George Knapp listening to That UFO Podcast and having one hell of a good time.
Did you know that podcast advertising is way more effective than display advertising? With 67% of listeners remembering brands and 63% making a purchase after hearing them. Whether you want to diversify your ad spend, add a new marketing stream, or test out podcast ads, Zencastr's creator network makes it easy for brands to connect with podcasters. Zencastr's mission is to make podcast advertisements as easy and accessible to business owners as Google or Facebook. Host-read ads like this are the most effective form of podcast advertising. Zencastr works with podcasters to help create unique to them ad spots that create brand awareness and conversion. Zencastr's creator network is the perfect place for you to get into podcast ads and sponsor your favourite creators like me. I've worked with Zencastr now for some time, and they truly put the content creators and the listeners at the heart of what they do. As a huge fan of podcasts myself, and I really mean that, I love podcasts, I often buy products or services that I find useful to me based on those pods that I'm listening to. It supports them, and there's usually a good discount to go along with it. So if you're interested in sponsoring this show or another podcast with adverts for your business, go to zen.ai/thatufopod1, that's the number one, or click the link in the description and fill out the contact information so Zencastr can help you bring your business story to life. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. My name is Andy, and I am honoured, delighted, and overjoyed to be joined by one of the world's foremost names in the study of UFOs, a gentleman with a master's degree in astrophysics, a PhD in artificial intelligence, an active investor in high technology, an author of some of the best books on the UFO phenomenon available, and today here to look at, among many things, the new edition of Trinity, The Best Kept Secret, a book he co-authored with Paola Harris, Mr. Jacques Vallée. Jacques, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. I look forward to it.
Yeah, listen, let's get straight into it. So just a reminder, folks, in May 2021, I interviewed Paola Harris on the book originally. So for the detailed story, please check that one out in the archive. Having Jacques on, we're going to look at the new information included in the book. However, Jacques, would you please begin by telling the listeners who may not be familiar with the Trinity case a little bit about it, but also what's brought about a second edition of the book?
You're talking about the Trinity case, right?
Yeah.
Yes. I was invited into the case by Paola Harris, who had already done about 3 years of work. She was one of the first people who became aware that the witnesses, who by then were in their late 60s and early 70s, were, for the first time, were talking about what they had seen all the way back in 1945. She was, number one, she was amazed that the secret had been kept, you know, so long, because, you know, many witnesses want to be on TV, or they want to tell their story, or they just feel a need to tell their story, even if it's not to the media, but to someone like me, or to a scientist, or to an investigator. So that was amazing. And the other thing that was amazing was all the complexity of the case as she got into it. And a couple of other people had interviewed at least one of the witnesses, but there was also a scientific aspect involved, and she invited me into the case to look at that. Actually, there were two. One was the object itself, which had very interesting characteristics that had never been seen before. And it wasn't a flying saucer. Remember, the term flying saucer was introduced in 1947, 2 years later, by Kenneth Arnold. There was no U.S. Air Force. Of course, there were airplanes, but they were Army Air Force. The pilots were in Army uniforms. And so all the things that we imagine going on around the UFO case were not present. There was the witnesses were two children who were taking care of their father's ranch. Of course, in those years, all the adults were, unless they were essential for the economy, they were at war still. They were still, in being repatriated. This was just the end of the war in Europe, but the war in the Pacific was still going on. So there is a very powerful, aspect of this case, which has to do with modern history. The other aspect is the object itself. I mean, the object itself didn't resemble anything that the witnesses had seen before. It was a large oval. They called it an avocado. Of course, where in New Mexico, people speak indifferently Spanish or English. But they came from a Spanish-speaking family. So they call it an avocado. It's the size of two trucks. It's heavy. It has hit a communication tower and then plowed a boulevard down the hill, apparently under power. And those are the things that Paola and I wanted to investigate and really get more of an understanding of what that entire situation was. The first witness was not the kids. The first witness was a very experienced bomber pilot named Brothy, B-R-O-T-H-Y, who was somewhat older than most of the pilots in the Army Air Force. He joined as what they called an old man. If you were over 40 for the Army, you were recruited as an old man category. And I don't think of 40 being old, but apparently the Army did in those days, because many of the recruits were in their, in their 20s and early 30s. He's coming in for a landing with a bomber, coming in for a landing at Alamogordo, which is the air base inside White Sands. White Sands is this very large area where the first atom bomb had been tested, in quotes, a few weeks before. The tower at Alamogordo asked him to look at the communication tower that is on that ranch, on the father's land, of the two kids. And he circles that tower and sees that the tower has been bent and the tower is no longer communicating. It's not a military tower. It's right outside, about 20 miles outside the White Sands territory where the bomb had been exploded, but it controls the both civilian and military airplanes around the classified area, which is still classified at that point. The pilot reports that the tower is bent, has lost communication, and he then sees some smoke, reports that there is an oval object in the bushes, in the cactus, and it's very sparse vegetation there, and thinks that the object is on fire. In fact, the object is not on fire, but the the vegetation is. And then he reports to two kids. He says that he sees two little kids on horseback next to the area where the object has, quote, crashed. Although Paola and I have become convinced that it was a controlled crash, based on the descriptions of the object that we get from the two kids. So it's a very unusual case because we can place the three witnesses at the site at the time when the object just crashed. We have their testimony of all three of them. And then we have the fact that the kids are going to stay there for the next 10 days, watching the recovery. And by the time I got involved and caught up with Paola, one of the witnesses, Mr. Baca, had died, but the other one was still very much alive, Mr. Padilla, Jose Padilla. In fact, he's a few years older than I am, and we've become friends as a result of, you know, my frequent trips there to continue the investigation. The case is extraordinary because, again, we can place the witnesses at the site. They were the first responders. Of course, they thought it had to do with the war, and they had no concept of, you know, UFOs. The term UFO isn't invented yet. It's going to be invented by the U.S. Air Force after 1947. President Truman is going to create the Air Force, to write it into existence as separate from the Army, 2 years later. The CIA doesn't exist. The CIA is going to be created into existence, again, by President Truman 2 years later. So we're still most able-bodied Americans are still in uniform. They are scattered between Europe and Japan. The war in Europe is over. Hitler has died. Stalin is reorganizing the Red Army. There's nothing left in Germany. The Red Army is sweeping through Manchuria and China, pushing the Japanese out of China. They had invaded China, and then getting ready to attack Japan from the north. Japan is also going to be attacked by the Navy. I've read all the books that have come out in the last few years. You know, many of the documents were not exactly classified, but they were not available to scholars until just a few years ago. It took 50 years to assemble and document all the papers from different nations. A lot of it is here at Stanford. I mean, not here because I'm in Paris, but it's all over in Palo Alto. And the historians had time to study it and to publish a number of books that I read in preparation for writing Trinity. I was stunned when I read and when I realized what had happened. And I realized also why I didn't know, after so many years of studying UFOs, I had never heard of that case. The case really wasn't in the literature, except in a couple of footnotes. One book has a short chapter about it, but essentially it had not been researched at the site. And the reason we didn't know about it is that the object was recovered by the Manhattan Project, by the Army, was managing the Manhattan Project. And it went very likely to Los Alamos. And after that, it would be covered by the atomic secrets and not by the normal Pentagon secrets. It was covered under the nuclear secrets. And we know that because there is a, I found a note from another unrelated investigation. In the 50s, there were a number of UFOs seen over Washington that actually went over the forbidden space, over the Pentagon and the White House. Fighters were sent after them, of course, and one fighter was authorized to shot at a UFO, destroyed part of it. The part that fell down was recovered, and later the United States shared the part of that material, and we can talk about materials later if you want to, but they had, first shot at that material, and they shared it with the Canadians. The Canadians had a UFO project, and they told the Canadians that in the U.S., this was classified higher than the nuclear bomb. So we know that from, official channels, not from the witnesses themselves. So the secret was kept, and it's still kept. We don't know where the object went. However, we have the witnesses who were there day after day after day. It took 10 days to recover this object and to get it on the truck and to clean up the site as best as they could and to take everything away. The kids were watching every day. And in the book, in Trinity, we have reconstructed what happened day after day after day, including the weather conditions and everything else. So we know a lot about how that object was recovered, and we have a pretty good idea of where it went.
Babbel is one of today's sponsors, and they are the best way for you to begin to learn a new language. Immersing yourself in the language of your choice from day one through a whole range of learning styles, including podcasts, games, and online classes. It's available on desktop or through their app. Babbel's courses are created by didactics experts and focus on real-life situations. So if you're holidaying in France and spot a UFO, you can get locals' attention quickly and efficiently. The lessons are as short as 15 minutes and fit into any schedule and can be downloaded to work on offline while on the go. With the help of everyday dialogue exercises and the speech recognition software, learners can practice their pronunciation, and regular vocabulary repetition ensures that what is learned is memorized over the long term. I can already hear some of you listeners getting in touch to tell me I should really learn English given my dodgy accent. When you buy a 6-month subscription to Babbel, you receive 6 months extra for free by using the code zen.ai/UFOBabbel. That's UFOBABBEL. Pay for 6 months and learn for a whole year. Get info and redeem the code at babbel.com/audio. Folks, today is the day you finally decide to make a life-changing decision and learn that new language. Thank you very much for that lovely summary of the event. I'd love to know...
Long exposition, I apologize, but there were all these factors combining together in that case.
No, there's so much to discuss. And I'd love to know, firstly, 1 month prior to this crash or controlled crash, there was an atomic test 20 miles away from the site. Do you think that atomic test in any way affected the environment that caused the crash? Or do you think it was potentially a way we alerted something else to what we were doing?
Well, I can only speculate, about what happened. It was very clear that object was not human. It was at least not human from the United States or Russia or Germany that might have been spying on White Sands, on the Atomic Center. Mm. Why would it crash? I mean, that's a question that people have very often. they say, okay, you know, we can believe that these objects are real, these UFOs are there, but you're telling us about these accidents. I mean, if you came from the other end of the universe, why would you crash on somebody's ranch? You know, you would master enough of the physical characteristics that you could land there. Well, what if it's a gift? What if it's a signal? After all, history has just changed for the first time. You know, mankind has demonstrated mastery of nuclear processes. Many scientists did not believe that you could make an atom bomb. Here, you know, the scientists who were gathered there were the elite of the science across around the world. You know, they were Germans. They were Italians, like Fermi, Enrico Fermi. They were Americans. They were Poles. They were people from all over the world who had fled the Nazi, and there were a couple of Nobel prizes, and they demonstrated, you know, the nuclear power. Contrary to what many people think, the army did not exactly embrace the idea of using atom bombs. General Eisenhower, General Sherman separately went to the White House to see the president and told him that the army should not use the bomb. Contrary to, you know, people think, well, you know, the army, the military wanted, you know, more power, more bombs, more explosions and so on. And that's why they were crazy enough to use this nuclear weapon. The army thought that if the bomb was used, the nature of war was going to change forever, and that the wars, conflicts would become unmanageable, and that the, you know, and can put that in the context of what happens now in Ukraine. I mean, are we going to see this? You know, for all that time, the atom bomb has never been used. It has been refined, has been reshaped, it has been experimented with, you know, by the US, by Russia, by France, by other countries, but it has never been used in conflict, even though the temptation was probably very, very high. So we're back at a time where, you know, for one thing, I've learned a lot of history. You know, I was born in France when France was essentially, you know, invaded by the Germans. So the first 5 years of my life, I was in occupied France. I remember the conditions there. I remember what the war was like, because our town was a key strategic point and it was attacked, you know, repeatedly. And you know, I can place myself in the conditions where people were in the United States in 1945. The President Truman emerges from this with an extraordinary character. I mean, he had to make the decision himself to use a bomb. The Pentagon had ordered 500,000 Purple Hearts in anticipation of the battle in Japan that was coming up, where the Russians would invade from the north and we would supply them with the American fleet and the American Air Force. The Navy had 100 aircraft carriers in the Pacific. Many of them were just old ships where the deck had been flattened so that they could put airplanes, you know, but the force was extraordinary. And Japan had amassed a million men in the north of Japan behind huge fortifications. President Truman felt that he could not allow that many young Americans to die, and he allowed the two bombs to be used at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So that's the context. Now, as you know, your question is, what was that UFO doing crashing on that ranch, you know, 20 miles from the place where the atom bomb had, in a forbidden area? Now, nobody saw it coming. I mean, it wasn't on radar, as far as we know. It came out of nowhere, hit that tower, and crashed on that ranch where it was available for the army to come and retrieve it. Is that a signal? I don't know. I mean, I'm strongly tempted to say somebody else was. After all, when a planet has a civilization on it, and that civilization develops the atom bomb, you know, if there are other forms of life around, that might warrant an intervention. An intervention where there was a demonstration that there was something even more powerful than the atom bomb, because the kids are going to be watching. And again, we've reconstructed, Paola and I, what happened day after day. There is a point where the kids can get close to the object. The beings that were seen inside the object have been taken away, or they have moved away at night. We don't know what happened to them, but the object is there and it's open. The father of the kids goes there with a New Mexico policeman, state police. They tell the kids never to talk about this. They say, this is not for our family. This is not for you to talk about. This is for the army, and you know, this is for the Pentagon. You don't talk about that to your friends. Okay? And they will follow that for the rest of their life. You know, Roswell is going to happen 2 years later. They don't come up at the time of Roswell to say, look, we saw something too. The case remained secret on the side of the kids, and it remained secret on the side of Project Manhattan that morphed into the Atomic Energy Commission. We also know that because Remy Baca is going to grow up to be a businessman in the state of Washington, and he's going to work on the political side with Dixie Lee Ray, governor of Washington. Dixie Lee Ray was a very smart woman. She was a physicist. She ran for governor of Washington, was elected as governor of Washington, and then later was director of the Atomic Energy Commission, which is now has morphed into the Department of Energy, which has its own clearances about nuclear matters. During her re-election, she talks with Remy Baca, who is going to energize the Spanish-speaking community in Washington to vote for her. And so they are working together on the campaign to get her elected governor. And she knows what he has seen as a kid. She goes to a safe and shows him the report. Of course, he's not allowed to keep it or to read it, but she wants him to know that there is a report about the object that was recovered at the ranch, and that object that he saw. So, you know, I try to think as a scientist and not jump to conclusions or make up hypotheses, because you can spend the rest of your life making up hypotheses. I mean, you know, it's a big universe out there with billions and billions of stars, as Carl Sagan said. So it's not, speculation is useless. I mean, you have to deal with the fact. The fact is that thing crash landed under power. The kids are going to look at it very carefully. Mr. Padilla is going to go inside, gave me a very good description, and I wanted the dimensions and everything else. I wanted to know if the floor was flat. I wanted to know something about the materials. I mean, the things that, you know, a good investigator would want to know. Hmm. And the space for an engine was underneath the egg-shaped object, the avocado, which was the size of two trucks, two fairly large trucks, 15 feet high. And the under the floor, there would have been 2.5 feet of space over maybe 5 feet long. That space is closed. And this is the bottom of the craft that has, you know, pushed the dirt all the way down the hill, okay? It's scratched, but it's not broken. There is no opening there. There is no propeller, and there is no jet, and there is nothing to see. That's where a propulsion system would be. What kind of a propulsion system can we think of that would fit in that space and would take you, you know, potentially would take you to outer space? I mean, at this point, we have no idea. Of course, you know, when it was taken to Los Alamos, I assume that scientists have looked at it. It's not obvious to me that we have made any progress in finding the key, because when, you know, last week I was watching our most modern rocket going up, and it was going up with essentially, you know, classic propellant. So we certainly don't have the mastery of anything approaching anti-gravity that could take us into space. We may be able to use forms of manipulated gravity once we're in orbit, you know, far from the Earth, where a small push could get you to accelerate and so on. I mean, you know, I've looked at proposals for companies that propose to do that, and they can demonstrate something along those lines, maybe. And I've looked at those business plans as an potential investor, but there is nothing like, you know, what we know the UFOs are doing.
You've beautifully captured a very horrific time in human history, talking about the 40s through to the war, the end of the war, the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You've mentioned was the only two times in history atomic weapons have been used in the act of warfare. However, in the decades preceding those events, the testing of atomic weapons has happened over and over and over again. It would seem if these were warnings, we've not listened to the warnings as a species and continue to stockpile the weapons. And as of now, we luckily, thank God, haven't used them in a warfare setting, and hopefully that never happens. But how do you see the phenomenon's continued presence through the decades? Are we still being observed because of this continued stockpiling and testing of weapons above ground, under the water, and underground as well?
Well, it's tempting to speculate that there is another form of life that's watching over us. Hopefully they are friendly. So far, most of the encounters that I know about have not taken the form of an attack, except for a group of cases where the witnesses were harmed, either by proximity to an object or, in some cases, direct energy from the object, you know, affecting them, okay? And I'm familiar with that because that's part of the databases that we've built. You know, the bomb, if you read the history books, they say that there was a test at Trinity of an atomic bomb and that it worked, and that encouraged then the army to go on and drop two bombs on Japan. Well, that's true. But you cannot really test an atom bomb. You know, either it works or it doesn't. And when this was a full-scale plutonium bomb, it was equivalent in power to the one that essentially vaporized Nagasaki. Okay. A lot of the plutonium was not burned or part of the explosion, and it fell on the entire area. And when, you know, we found new witnesses, when we talked to them about what happened to their family at that point and what they saw in terms of, you know, residue or objects or evidence of the landing of the craft, the first thing they do is to tell us about the devastation in New Mexico. And with, you know, they pull out pictures of the kids who died when they were 18 of radiation injuries or of radiation poisoning. They tell us why, you know, we understand why there was a secret until they blew up the bomb and could verify it worked. Enrico Fermi, who was there, did a quick calculation and saw that the explosion was four times more powerful than they had calculated, which in atomic physics isn't bad, you know, in terms of solving the equations. But the fact is it was a huge explosion. And the wind then took the residue of the plutonium and the radioactive cloud went over the area where the kids and their family were and that ranch. Now, a month later, this thing lands there. It's practically intact. You know, you're tempted to think that this was a gift, that this was a demonstration. You think you're smart, you know, you've mastered atomic energy on Earth for the first time in, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. You've gotten to that point. Now, look at this. You know, so it's tempting to think of it in those terms. However, you know, in the last 40 years, we've gone to the edge of nuclear conflict three times, mostly by accident. We don't know about the Russian side, but we know that we did. I mean, we know that there was one time when the strategic command was in the air. With instructions, I mean, on the way to bombing Russia, based on false signals and false computer programs that had thought that they had detected an attack. So much for artificial intelligence. And yeah, that is very sobering, but UFOs didn't intervene. You know, there was no intervention to stop the B-52s. So what does that mean? Well, it means that we'll have to be responsible with what we do, with what we develop. I was amazed by some of the things I learned. Paola and I went to the test site when it was open. You know, they open it twice a year, and I highly recommend going there because you get it. I mean, you get the scale of things. You get an instant lesson in modern history. But there is a little brochure that they sell, which is an army brochure about the history of the site. When they did that explosion, which was not a test, I mean, it's a test in the sense that they hadn't done it before, but a test in physics, you know, is you take a small glass or something and you put something in it and you watch a reaction, and if the reaction works, then you do it at a larger scale and then you get a patent and so on. There was no way to test the bomb other than blow up a full-scale bomb. They realized when they looked at the destruction of the radioactivity in New Mexico, which they could see pretty much right away, that radioactivity isn't the main purpose of having the bomb. The main purpose of having the bomb is to is a very, very high millions of degrees of heat and a wind that will destroy any construction or any, you know. And the fact that it leaves a radioactive trace is a secondary thing. Of course, it's going to destroy life, but that's not really the point. I mean, at that point, you've destroyed what you wanted to destroy on a large scale. So, and I don't think the Japanese know that, but the two bombs that were taken by the Enola Gay and the other airplanes over to Japan were reset so that they did not explode at ground level as they did in New Mexico. They blew up the bombs at 2,000 feet in the air, 2,000 meters in the air, so that the radioactivity would be minimized at ground level. And again, I don't think the Japanese know that. All those things, I mean, you have to go into details when you do that kind of investigation. It's taken us, you know, in the case, in my case, 4 years, for Paola, 7 years. And we're still finding details about artifacts, about special things that were retrieved from the avocado. We still find witnesses who came in later and remembered what conditions were there. And so I think we're emerging with quite a lesson in how to do that kind of investigation and how to deal with the witnesses and how to deal with the human side of that, and also the physics. I mean, how was that thing built to be able to perform all these? The one time when I had an argument with Paola was I wanted to go back and interview Mr. Padilla about exactly what kind of truck the Army had brought to the site to recover what they called an experimental weather balloon. Okay, so we know it's not the weather balloon. It's not an experimental weather balloon. But an officer went to the home of Mr. Padilla's father, Faustino Padilla, who owned the ranch, was operating the ranch, and told him that, speaking Spanish, we're going to need to cut your fence to build a gate. And Faustino says, why do you need to? I mean, I have a perfect good gate for the cattle trucks. You know, the cattle goes in and out, and you can use that. The army guy says, no, we're going to have to bring a big truck. And Mr. Padilla described to me the truck they brought was one of those huge army trucks that can carry two tanks on what they call a low boy, which is a platform they can lower behind the tractor of the truck. That truck was enormous, and they cut. I've seen where they cut the gate. Mr. Padilla took me there, and it was a large thing, and then they had to build a road all the way to where the object was, and they had to bring a crane to lift it and put it on the low boy and drive away with it. So that was quite an operation. It took 10 days, and we've reconstructed what happened, you know, each one of those 10 days.
Now, a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. Day to day, life comes at you fast, and like anyone, I can get stuck focusing on problems rather than looking for solutions. Whether that's in my professional 9-to-5, on the podcast, or even just as a parent. It can be tough to train your brain to think differently, but it is possible. There is no better time to start making a change than today, and when you finally learn to find your own solutions, there is no better feeling. A therapist can help you become a better problem solver, making it easier to accomplish those goals you've been struggling to. For many, using BetterHelp has allowed them to unload stress, heal emotional scars, or even help with anxiety and depression. For me, the flexibility of being able to access online help through messaging on the app or even voice or video calls is a win, not to mention it's convenient and affordable. All you need to do is fill in a very brief survey and BetterHelp will match you with a therapist that suits your needs. You can of course swap your therapist at any time. When you want to be a better problem solver, therapy can get you there. Visit betterhelp.com/thatufo today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/thatufo. The research in the book is fantastic. It's thorough, it's detailed, and like you say, there are many examples that are very, very well explained. I want to read a quote from Christopher Mellon, who many folks will know as the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the United States. He called the data within the book fresh reason to believe that our government is concealing physical proof of alien technology. Read the book and, if persuaded, join the millions of Americans seeking a straight answer. Jacques, I want to know, what do you hope this release of the second edition of the book adds to the overall UFO conversation?
So, I'm basically an information scientist by training, although the last 20 years or so I've been investing in high technology companies. Over the years, I've compiled a number of databases looking for the best cases, but also looking for models of, not just one case at a time, but looking for models of behavior of the different types of craft, essentially, and applying AI to that mass of data. As part of the ATIP program, or the BAS program, the Bigelow Aerospace program, I was in charge of building the database that has now gone on to other sites. And as you may know, the project is still classified, or the results of the project are still classified. Certainly the Trinity case and two other cases emerge as the best source of information we have about the craft themselves, and the mechanics and the physics and all of that. And here, we ended up building the data warehouse. It was really a series of databases. We ended up with 240,000 cases from all over the world. One thing that worries me about what's going on now, as far as I can tell what's going on now, after congressional review and what the Pentagon is doing, is that they are focusing entirely on military cases. Now, military cases are very good because the military has sensors and, special cameras and radar and so on, but it's only less than 10% of the database. The other 90% are farmers in their field and, people fishing and people and kids running around in the countryside who see things for a long time that puzzle them, and we get a lot of data from that. So I'm worried about the fact that we're going to rush too quickly based on a few cases. The Nimitz case is extraordinary. Okay? It's extraordinary because it happens over a number of ships that are full of electronics and designed to track things over the ocean and all the way to space. So with very advanced radars and very advanced cameras, very advanced infrared, and pilots who are highly trained and extraordinary planes. So you would think that those cases would be even better than what we have with Trinity in terms of finding out what the technology is. But again, that's one case, as good as it is. And it's under the constraints of the military, which means much of the data is still secret. We haven't had access to it. Remember, in the case of the Nimitz, it was a plane that landed on the deck. Two guys came out, spoke to the, you know, to the commanding group, took the data from the radars, and flew off. We don't know who they were. Okay, we don't know where they went. Okay, so we can speculate based on the data, which is very good from the pilots, you know, and to some extent from the radar people who can describe what they saw on their screen. But that's not the way you do physics, okay? And in physics, you don't want to work on half of the problem. You want to have the whole problem. So my training is to look at patterns of things, not just one thing at a time. There are people who are much better than I am at looking at one case at a time, doing the investigation, getting the science data. There are three cases that I go into in great detail in Trinity. There is the case we've just talked about at the test site. What about Socorro? Socorro is 8 miles due north of this case. In Socorro, 1964, Lonnie Zamora, an old highway patrolman from New Mexico, sees an object that he thinks there is an explosion. So he drives into the desert, which I've done, and it's the conditions haven't changed very much. It's still pretty rough terrain. And he comes out in front of an object that has landed in a gully with an extraordinary landing gear that's adaptable to the terrain, which is not flat. And there are two creatures there. The object is oval, pretty much like the one in Trinity. It's a little bit smaller. There are two creatures there that match the description of the creatures at Trinity. The creatures at Trinity were about the size of the kids. The kids go up to thinking that they are going to help a crew that has crashed on their land. They get to 200 feet. Then they realize these are not quite human. They are certainly not, you know, what they expected, not pilots. They move around in a strange way, and the kids are afraid and remain frozen there. The case in Socorro, the two entities that are there are humanoid. They are just like at Trinity. They breathe the air. You know, we don't expect an alien to come from Andromeda and breathe the air. I mean, when we go to the moon, we're going to have a breathing equipment. When we go to Mars, we're going to have breathing equipment. We're going to walk in a particular way, and so on, adapted to the gravity. We'll have all this gear. The two humanoids are looking at Zamora. There is apparently some sort of communication, psychic or not, with him. They get back into the object somehow. The object makes a lot of noise, lifts off the ground, stops making any noise, and then moves away. In the book in Trinity, at the time I was working with Dr. Hynek. As you know, Dr. Hynek was sent to investigate Socorro by the Air Force under Project Blue Book. We were a group of us at Northwestern University and the University of Chicago were very interested in the case. We were in communication with him. And when he brought the data he had, we formed a group to study the data. So I know the data from Socorro very well. We don't really understand the propulsion system of that object. There were a lot of speculations. Again, it was smaller than the one at Trinity, and it went off. And there is one case in my book, with Paola, that had never been reported before, as the object flew off. It flew off towards the mountains, and it actually, a military car was stopped working, was frozen as the object became very bright over the car. That was reported by, you know, an officer. That case hadn't been published before. So we know a lot. We know Socorro wasn't a joke, wasn't a hoax, it wasn't a balloon. We know the weight. And in both cases, we end up with a weight of several tons. In Socorro, it was, you know, about 5 tons based on the imprints that were left. Socorro was not investigated by a UFO group or an amateur group, although amateur groups have done a very good job of documenting traces and so on. But here there was the state police, there was the FBI that was in town. They had no jurisdiction there, but they helped secure the traces. So we know the traces very well. They photographed the traces. Dr. Hynek saw the evidence around the site. There was no question there was a very heavy object that landed there in the desert. The third case is in France, August 1st, 1965, a year after Socorro. A farmer that I've met, I've gone to that site and I've met several of the people involved over a number of days. I didn't go there at the time. I went there, you know, about 15 years ago. He saw, an oval object. There is no disc in any of that. There is no flying saucer in this book. He saw an object that had landed in the field. Again, Socorro and Valenzuela are not crashes. They are controlled landings, very sophisticated controlled landings. There are two humanoids in front. They breathe our air. They have two eyes. They have small nose, small mouth, just like what the witnesses at Trinity have described. Remember, in 64, 65, nobody had heard about Trinity. You know, Trinity only came out about 10 years ago, 10, 12 years ago. All that time, it had been, the witnesses had been silent. So we have three cases that match. The case in Valenzuela, the witness was highly regarded. He was a businessman and a farmer. He immediately after the case went to the police. The police called the Air Force. The Army went there. The customs people went there. And there was, it was investigated by 5 different agencies of the French government, all looking for a common explanation, you know, some sort of advanced helicopter that came from somewhere. And all of them concluded that the case was unidentified. After extensive investigation, interviews of the witnesses and so on. So we're dealing not just with one case, but we're dealing with a pattern of very sophisticated observations of similar objects and similar creatures, similar traces. Both in the United States and in Europe. That's what I would like to present to scientists, you know, would like people to look at that combination of factors and start really thinking about it in system terms. So the reason I'm here in Paris is that the French Space Agency has a group that has been studying UFOs officially with an official budget for 40 years, which has never happened in the United States. I mean, NASA has never wanted to look at it. They have a database which is public. There's the Space Agency is a civilian agency. It's not, although in our advisory group for the agency, there are representatives of the army, the French intelligence, and the French Air Force, as well as the Weather Bureau, as well as a number of sociologists and psychologists and so on. So it's a good group. It's a group that has a lot of years studying cases, primarily in France, which is their only jurisdiction. But that's the group that had studied Valensole. And there is an international meeting in 2 weeks that I'm going to in Toulouse. Toulouse is the main center for French space research, both Airbus space, the space part of Airbus and the French Space Agency have headquarters there. And all the scientific labs are there. And six countries are coming, including Germany and the UK, Holland, Italy, and Spain. And we'll be comparing notes about, the current cases around the world for 2 full days. This is not public. It's a closed meeting, but the proceedings will be published in time after they are edited. I'm making a presentation there about Trinity.
I would love to ask, how do we progress? Is it meetings of scientists and investigators like yourself pushing this subject forward? You mentioned the Nimitz case, for example, is rich with data and electronic sensors and equipment and probably very clear video and photographs that we haven't yet seen publicly. And then we have cases that are 60 to 80 years old, like Trinity or the, Sirocco case. Where is that middle ground? Is it public or private groups like yourselves, like the Galileo Project, that can really take this conversation forward?
I'm happy to have lived long enough. You can see my white hair to see the day when the subject is at least acknowledged officially, by both the intelligence community, by Harvard, University, by NASA. Now, we'll have a spokesperson from NASA at our meeting in Toulouse, addressing by video, but addressing the scientists there. So this is what Dr. Hynek was hoping to see, what Dr. McDonald was hoping to see eventually, that the subject would be open, would be that the ridicule would be removed, from it, and that it would be okay for scientists to study UFOs, either on their own time or as I've done, or in a funded as part of a funded project. Galileo is a funded project, fortunately, but it's funded privately. We should get to the point where, we could write a proposal to the National Science Foundation to study at least the civilian cases. There is a case to be made for a classified study to go on. And people, many people in the field disagree with me on that. And they say, let everything be open. The database to which I contributed, this was, a big part of the budget that was spent under the BAS ATIP project. There were, I probably shouldn't tell you how many people were involved, but it was, a significant group, including translators of Spanish, French, Italian, Russian, so on, to have a complete data warehouse, all in English, with a fairly sophisticated structure on which we could build the AI component. the project was stopped before we could get to that, which is a pity, but there are other, you know, talented people in computer science who can pick it up under classified, again, under classification and move it forward. The reason not to disclose it today, I mean, some of the data in it came from civilian sources, and it's known, it came from UFON, it came from things like that, from the French files, but it's open. Anybody can look at it, anybody can do what we did, essentially, except that the structure is somewhat sophisticated in anticipation of doing AI. But there are a number of cases that are medical cases that those cannot be, should not be declassified until they are sanitized, until there is a protection of the witnesses, protection of the people who've been injured, and so on. And there is a surprising number of cases where we have biological data, either in the form of superficial effects, or in the case of injuries, including cases of death. Although not directly in military encounters, but people who died as a result of exposure to something that may have been accidental, well, not necessarily, I don't know, directed energy directed at them. Although, you know, that part of the research hasn't been completed. My hope is, you know, the project was terminated fairly arbitrarily after 2 years. It was designed to go on another 3 years. If it had gone on another 3 years, we would have built the AI component completely. Now, I've used AI in my own work. You know, there is a misunderstanding about AI. AI is a very... It's easy to talk about AI now, and it's very popular, and it's very mysterious. AI shouldn't be mysterious. I mean, AI comes in a number of types of things. You know, my doctorate dissertation was about building an AI program for stellar astronomy to facilitate studies of the stars. And you know, my professors told me it couldn't be done. I wanted the system to answer English questions about stars and come out with numerical answers. That was the first time it was done. But it was done as a helper to an astronomer, so that an astronomer didn't have to write a program every time, go run the program, which in those days would take 24 hours to get the results. Here you could tell the question in English and you'd get an instant answer like 15.6%. Okay, so that was in 1968. Okay, 1968. So since then, there have been two more levels of AI development. Now we know we can do that, and we know we can do a lot more. But the AI, the new AI system I wrote in the 80s was just to help me sift through all the UFO reports fairly quickly so that I wouldn't forget a particular pattern that might have explained the data. Again, much of the data can be explained, okay? And it's still true today. The first thing we have to do is to concentrate on, you know, take the 260,000 cases we have so far. We can get much more, but what's the point of getting much more if it's junk? So we know that out of that, maybe only 10% is really the stuff we should turn over to the labs, to the physicists, to the chemists, to the astronomers, and so on. So the AI should be helping us along the way to narrow it down to those cases that are truly unexplained. not necessarily unexplainable, but unexplained so far. And, you know, that what I built in 1985 was pretty good. It would go over something like 40 or 50 different hypotheses for which the pattern was known that I could apply to the cases I had. And the program would engage in a dialogue with me that was like, have you thought of this? Have you thought of that? Have you thought of that third thing it could be? So that, you know, the human mind makes up a hypothesis, and then all you see is that hypothesis. But there may be something else going on that has happened in other cases that you forgot. The system isn't going to forget it. And it wasn't a big program. You know, it wasn't very sophisticated, but it remembered every single explanation we had found so far in other cases, and then it wouldn't forget it. So again, we should demystify AI. You know, I see people talking about AI is going to be this magical thing that, you know, we shouldn't apply a lot of sophisticated AI to that data until we've cleaned it up. And, you know, I can tell you without violating any, you know, any secrecy or any clearance, we didn't get to the point where we could clean it up the way we wanted to clean it up because we only had 2 years. So if there is something to do out there is to review that data very carefully and, you know, work on it to the point where it could be presented to the different scientific disciplines for study.
If you could just let us know and let the listeners know, is there anything right now you are working on other than the French Space Agency group you'd like to let the listeners know about?
Well, you know, most of my work is in the US. I'm familiar with the French finds and with, you know, the European finds. There is a big decision that will have to be made in the US. And at the congressional hearings, I heard two different things from, you know, two of the representatives and people who were there from Congress. I heard this is so important that now it should be, you know, probably continue to be classified. It should be treated with a high priority because it could give the United States an advantage in technology, which is true. I also heard, you know, one of the congressmen say, you know, a lot of the data was gathered outside the United States. We should open the doors and the windows and have some sort of global, which we know how to do. I mean, you know, we've been talking to the Russians about nuclear war, you know, for the last 70 years. Now, that doesn't mean that we tell them our secrets, and they certainly don't tell us their secrets. But we don't, at some level, we don't need the secrets. We can talk about, you know, what it all means, because this happens all over the world. The U.S., you know, the part of the U.S. that's where there are people able to watch the sky is 2% of the planet. You know, what about the other 98%? Wouldn't you want to know what's going on there? Well, lots of things are going on there, and people are intimidated by the U.S., so they don't want to look silly, especially if there are tenured professors at a university somewhere, and they know of a particular case that the U.S. should know about, but they're not going to tell the U.S. because they don't want to be laughed at, you know, on NBC News. Okay, so that has prevented all these years. I've been one of the few people who sort of had access to, you know, had friends in both and colleagues in both situations. There is a point where I would argue that we need to be more open, and we need to have, whether it's under the UN or under some other group that has a proper structure, you know, we need to talk. We really need to talk. I recognize also, I mean, I had, you know, all of us had the right clearances under the ATIP program. I no longer have that clearance, but obviously, you know, I'm still subject to the same regulations. The people with clearances are not going to violate their clearances when they talk to, you know, the Germans or the Spaniards. But the data itself, a lot of it comes from civilian population. Some of it is in the books that have already been published. So why don't we look at this as scientists, you know, as Dr. Loeb at Harvard has started to do, you know, and begin to look at the phenomenon as a massive, something that has a massive impact on us, you know, on the planet and on the population, and, you know, do it with the techniques we have already that have never been applied to it. What's stopping us? So that's my, you know, the I mean, that's what I emerge with, you know, and I've been working, we have a small group at Stanford, you know, around Dr. Nolan, and I've turned over to Dr. Nolan all the trace material I had from different countries, including from France, and, you know, we've published one paper already on describing the technology, the methodology of analysis, and we're going to publish more. And that's the way science works.
Well, Jacques, thank you so much for your time. Thank you very much for coming on. You've been very gracious, very generous, and I'll hold you to that and would love to get you back on to answer some of those listener questions in the near future. But thank you for all the work you've done and continue to do.
At your pleasure, sir.
That is all for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. Please remember to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. You can like, retweet and subscribe. That would all be very much appreciated. The shows are being uploaded onto YouTube as we speak more and more. You can sign up at patreon.com/thatufopodcast to access shows ad-free as well. Please get in touch on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, That UFO Podcast. Of course, on Twitter, it's @UFOUAPAM. And again, folks, as always, keep looking up. You never know what you might see.
It wasn't a Tic Tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer. A little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right outside of my window, and when I shoved out the screen, he made it an issue. I don't think he expected me to see his ass, but I'd had some champagne and smoked a little rat. Meditated again with Fateful on Meta. Can't imagine how it could have been any better. I got to the top of the stairs and there he was. I'm like, you awake? I was about to abduct you, cuz. I jumped back and nearly kissed myself. And I climbed out the window after the elf. And I woke up in my bed and there was something on my head. And everything was weird and everything was red. And I called up my boys. They thought this was noise. They thought it was a dream. They thought it was my toys. They thought it was my problems. And they think I should see therapy. And I don't know what to do because it doesn't really scare me. Consider your space, consider your lies, consider your life, consider your eyes.
That UFO podcast is powered by Zencastr. Zencastr is one of the world's leading platforms for recording and hosting podcasts. The open beta strives to put the power of studio quality remote video production into the hands of anyone with a story to tell. Features include HD video recording, studio quality sound, chat and footnotes. All running right from your browser so you can record from anywhere without ever installing anything. Check out the links in the show description to find out more.
Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is so delicious, so unbelievable, no word exists to describe it. It's better than mind-blowing, it's mouth-blowing. Bright, citrusy, and spicy, this newest flavor from Captain Morgan is a balanced blend of sweetness with delicious notes of lime and slightly spicy chili flavor that is great for an escape outdoors with your crew or your next hangout. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is best enjoyed as an ice-cold shot or as a chili lime twist on a classic as a spicy daiquiri. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, a touch of sweet, a kick of heat. Please drink responsibly. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, premium Caribbean rum with natural flavors, 35% alcohol by volume, Captain Morgan Rum Co., New York, New York.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable Pocket Hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.